Okay, my name is Paul Seeley. I was raised in a formal Christian home, but when I went to college, I decided that I really needed to look independently to decide what religion, if any, I wanted to be a part of. And I, in fact, began with the question of whether there even was a God and went through the different proofs for God. Came to the conclusion that there really was an intelligence and a person, a God in back of the universe. And then I thought, well, I'm not going to be biased. I'm going to get myself books from all the world religions and study and take a look at these different options. So I got a Bible, I got a Quran, I got the sayings of Confucius, which I didn't know was not a religion. I got Buddhism, and I got holy books from Hinduism, and I began reading those. And over several months of reading in each of them, I eventually felt that I really wasn't getting anywhere. I just couldn't make a decision as to what religion was the really true one. So as I was pondering that, I thought to myself, well, you've come to the conclusion that God exists, so why don't you ask him? Which made sense. So I prayed a simple prayer. God, I believe in you now. Now, what else, or who else am I supposed to believe in? And I could have turned over any of the books or opened any of them, but I opened up the Bible, and the first thing I saw was John 14:1. Where Jesus said, "You believe in God, believe also in me." And that was such a startling answer to prayer. I was in a state of shock and awe at that answer. And I realized that Jesus Christ must be the true way. And I took all the other books back to the library. And within the next few weeks, found a Christian church and came to know Jesus Christ personally. Following that, I really wanted to study the Bible, and I went to Bible college, and then on to a Christian college, where I majored in Bible. And from there, I went on to Westminster Theological Seminary. And when I graduated from seminary, I didn't feel called to teach or preach. I just felt called to research scripture and probably write. So, just taking various jobs, I made a living one way or the other and spent as much time as I could studying scripture. And my program was to go through every verse of the Bible, one by one. In looking at the original and reading two or three scholarly commentaries on each verse, which took me about 15 years. But at the same time, I read through a couple of Bible dictionaries A to Z, and I read through all of the primary sources from ancient history that I could lay my hands on, from the beginning of Sumerian history at about 2500 BC to 150 AD, so that I covered the whole Bible background, the historical background, and could see the Bible in its historical context. That was a long time goal, and when I finished that, then I began to research and write, and wrote a book on inspiration, inerrant wisdom. And then in 1991, I published my first really serious paper on the firmament in the water above in the Westminster Journal, Westminster Theological Journal. And after that, over the next few years, I published another one on the earth and the seas, which between the three articles draws out the cosmology of the Old Testament with its flat earth and the ocean below, and a solid firmament and an ocean above. And I had spent so long on those papers that they were very well documented, and some of them have been received and taken up by other evangelical scholars in their commentaries, and I think in probably other courses that I don't even know anything about. And then I went on, wrote on the. I thought the best way to get into Genesis. I was really concerned about Genesis 1 to 11, because that seemed to be where all the conflicts with science existed. And why was this, and how could you somehow get into those passages? I had made some start with the firmament, but I thought if I could get into the Tower of Babel at the end, that's the closest one to Abraham. So if I can get in there and figure that dating out, then I'm going to know where I am on the timeline of history. And I had no idea when I started how easy that was going to be. But the Tower of Babel tells us that they used baked brick, they used asphalt for mortar, they were building a tower, which most scholars identify as a ziggurat, and they wanted to build a city. And if you look in the archaeology of Mesopotamia, you find that all four of those aspects do not occur in the archaeological record until 3500 BC at the earliest. So the Tower of Babel has to be subsequent to 3500 BC, and that then put me into a time frame, at least at the one end. I also wrote a few articles more directly on science and scripture. I wrote one about concordism, how it really rewrites Genesis 1 based on science. That article, The First 4 Days of Genesis in Concordist Theory and in Biblical Context, it was published in the Perspectives on Science and Christian Faith. And is on the American Scientific Affiliation website. And I also published a letter, a paper on the ice core, the GISP-2 ice core, which is in Greenland, and is the one the Americans dug. And it goes down through at the very minimum 110,000 years. Annual layers of ice. And I did that really with reference to the flood, because if there had been a universal flood, it would either have washed over the ice core or under it. And if it went under it, then it probably would have floated the ice core away. And according to the scientists, the glaciologists who work on the ice cores, they say that the ice sheet on Greenland has been frozen that way for millennia, and so it hasn't moved. And the water, therefore, of a flood should have gone over the top. And if that had occurred, then you would have melted some ice. And when ice melts and then refreezes, it looks like Coke bottle glass, and so it's very visible, very obvious. And it's pretty rare in the GISP-2 ice core, because the GISP-2 ice core is at a very high location where it almost never goes below freezing. But there is no evidence of that kind in that ice core. And so the testimony of the ice core is that there was no global flood. Some have doubted, of course, those who don't want the Earth to be older than 6 or 10,000 years. Have tried to come away with some way to get around the 110,000 annual layers. But the layers are, the first 10,000 layers are marked by a particular kind of ice that occurs in Greenland, because during the winter there's no sunshine, and so the ice tends to be very compact. And then during the summer, the sun comes out, and the ice does not melt, but there's what they call ablation, which is sort of like evaporation, sort of. And that changes the crystals in the ice core. So in the first 10,000 years, you have these cycles of heavy dense ice followed by light airy ice, and those can be counted down, given you the first 10,000 years. At the same time, over those 10,000 years, and then in particular for the next 100,000, during the summer, and we use that loosely because sometimes when I say summer, it might really be spring or a little on the fall side. But in any case, I'm just going to say during the summer, the winds bring in dust from all around the world. But in the winter, that doesn't occur, or at least occurs so minimally that it's a great contrast. And so annually, you have two rings, two layers again, one of which is very dusty, and one of which is barely dusty. And so that enables you again to count the seasons and to know that you're actually dealing with seasons and no other time slot that would be any less often than annual. And the third thing that happens is that because the sun shines during the summer and not the winter, it affects the nitrogen in such a way that nitric acid is made in the atmosphere in the summer, but it doesn't occur in the winter. And so a third thing that happens in the first 10,000, and then I said only a second thing in the rest of the year, 100,000 years, but is that the summer layers have a nitric acid in them. And you can put run an electrical charge through the layers, and you get a big spike when it goes through really easy because of the acid. But in the winter layers, where you have no acid, the electricity doesn't go through, and so you just get a little, wasn't a spike, but anyway, some goes through, but not nearly as much. So again, you've got these peaks and valleys that go all the way down the ice core. So you end up with three independent indicators of annual years for the first 10,000 years, and then two independent indicators that go through the next 100,000 years. So there's no question really about the age of the of that ice core. Now, what I've been working on since then, and actually, like I said, worked on that with reference to the flood, is trying to understand the flood account better. It seems very clear. Okay. And secondly, geologists can track paleo floods back to 18,000 years before Christ. And there are a couple of those, and it's quite obvious when you have a flood, because it disturbs the rocks and the soil and so on, leaves certain indications, moving boulders and what have you. And so if there had been a flood in the time of Noah, which is, of course, long after 18,000 years ago, you should have evidence of it geologically. But in fact, there is no evidence of a flood in the time of Noah. Now, I might mention that when is the time of Noah? Of course, we can't date it 100%, but we can get a pretty good idea from the fact that the Tower of Babel is at 3,500, and that's going to occur not terribly long after the flood. And Adam, according to his culture, is not earlier than about 9 or 10,000 BC. Because he has a Neolithic culture, that is, he has domesticated animals and crops, which don't occur prior to about 9 or 10,000 BC. So the flood has to be somewhere between 9 or 10,000 and around 3,500. And you can zero in if you just split that in two, you're going to come up with maybe 6,000 or 5,000 or something that nature. And the clearest evidence of that date for Noah, I think, is the fact that when he gets off the boat, shortly after getting off the boat, he plants a vineyard. Now, in other words, they have domesticated grapes very close to the time of the flood. In the mounds or tells of the Near East, You can start at the top of some of these tells that go back to 9,000, and you find evidence of beans and wheat and barley and different crops at 9,000 and 8,000 and 7,000 and on down. But you don't find any domesticated grapes until you get down to about 3 or 4,000 BC. So that's again zeroing the flood in. Probably no earlier than, I mean, I think it's kind of generous to say 5,000, but certainly no earlier than 5,000. So we know, it's kind of a rough idea when the flood occurred or when we would date it. And if you go back then, let's say you have a date of 5,000. Of course, there were the Tower of Babel. I should say 3,500. It could be the Tower of Babel could be as late as 2,500. So it's between 35 and 25. So the flood again also could be down as low as 2,500. But if you look in the archaeological finds and sites, not only all over the Near East and indeed all over the world. For example, in Japan is the Jomon culture, which existed from about 9 or 10,000 BC down to about 300 AD. You find these cultures weren't disturbed by any flood, and even in the Near East, even in Mesopotamia, there are certainly local floods that disturb maybe very temporarily, but the culture itself goes on and is not seriously disrupted. So, judging from the archaeology of the Near East and all around the world, and judging from the lack of geological evidence, and judging from the way the ice core is held up, we have pretty strong evidence that there simply was no global flood. That puts us on to, okay, how about a local flood? That's the most logical answer to this. And as it turns out, there's excuse me, pretty good evidence that there was, in fact, a local flood that is probably the biblical flood. And that flood occurred around 2900 BC. And the reason we can tie the two together is because the Babylonian account, well, I should just go back one step here and say that of all the flood accounts, there's probably 150 or more accounts of the flood, of a flood at least, around the world. None of them are even remotely as close to the biblical account as is the Babylonian. The Babylonian account is the closest to the biblical account by far. And as a result, evangelical scholars, I don't know of any exceptions to this, evangelical scholars have concluded, I don't see what else you could conclude, but that the flood that the Babylonians are talking about is the same flood that the Bible is talking about. So we begin at that point, and then can we find out any more about the Babylonian flood? Since there's not very much more we can find out about the biblical. All we know from the biblical is roughly when it occurred, and it leaves a lot to be desired as far as historically zeroing in any further. But the Babylonian flood, we know there was a king named Gilgamesh, who was king of the city of Uruk. And he, even though he's a legendary king, he nevertheless is a real king because we found inscriptions about Gilgamesh, not just literature, but actual royal inscriptions. So he was an actual king, and he probably should be dated around 2650 BC. In the Gilgamesh epic, we learn that in Gilgamesh's travels, he went to see the Babylonian Noah. He went to visit him. And therefore, the tradition is that the flood occurred before Gilgamesh. Otherwise, of course, he couldn't go visit after the flood. Now, the interesting thing about this then is, well, when did this king that named in Sumerian named Zeusudra, when did or the excuse me, this Babylonian Noah, I should say, named Zeusudra, his father was a king. When did he live? Well, again, from the Sumerian king list, we learn that there was a king of the city of Shurippak named Ubar Tutu, and he's the father of Zeusudra. So he's the father of the Babylonian Noah. And we can use the Sumerian king list and the dating with Gilgamesh, count the number of kings, and make a rough calculation that this king, Ubertutu, and his son, Zeusudra, the Babylonian Noah, probably lived around 2900 BC. So now we know that this Babylonian flood, which is probably the biblical flood, probably occurred around 2900 BC. So now we look in the archaeological record. What do we find around 2900 BC? Well, 2900 BC occurs right at a dividing line between two cultures in Babylonia. The one is the Gemdet Nasser culture, and then at 2900 BC, the Gemdet Nasser culture ends, and what is called the first dynastic or dynastic one culture begins. And so it's a nice archaeological dividing point for this 2900 date. Now, when I say 2900, there is not an absolute certainty about that date. It could be 2800, or I suppose it could even go the other way. But in any case, it is right directly between those two cultural stratum. Well, when you look between those two stratum, you find there are three cities in southern Mesopotamia that have flood silt layers right there between the Gemdet Nasser and early dynastic one cultures. The one city is at Shurupak, the one silt layer is at Shurupak, and that is the city at which Zeusudra, I say Babylonian, that's actually his Sumerian name, but technically in another way it's just generally called Babylonia. That's where he lived, and there is I believe it's a 4 to 5 foot layer of silt there at Shurupak, and there's evidence that after that flood at Shurupak, that the city was deserted for a little while. Now there's also a 2 foot layer of probably flood sediment at Uruk, and again right at the same place in the cultural stratum. And then there's a small layer, only a 1 inch layer, at Kish, which is in the northern part of Sumeria. But it again is right there in the same place. So you've got three cities with a flood silt layer right at the point where the literary evidence indicates that we should find the flood. This tells me that this is probably the strongest case that can be made that the biblical flood was a local flood and that occurred around 2900 BC. Now, the problem that arises here is that flood, being from the Tigris and Euphrates, and being a river flood, probably never exceeded 40 feet in depth. And so, how can this flood destroy all mankind and get an ark into the Ararat Mountains? And the answer is it can't, and in fact didn't. Now, the Sumerian account says that the flood destroyed all mankind. In fact, the Babylonian accounts all agree on that, along with the biblical account. But in the Sumerian account, all mankind is just the Sumerians. But as it turns out archaeologically, we find that after 2900 BC, when this flood occurred, very shortly thereafter, dynastic one period begins, and cities are go right on, and there doesn't seem to be any serious disruption at all. So this thing has been blown out of proportion even at an early date. And then in the biblical account, it seems to have become greatly blown out of proportion. Perhaps for theological reasons, the writer of Genesis 6 through 9 also is, also wrote obviously 1 through 11, and he ties it very closely to creation. And he may be trying to make a statement that God, the God of creation, is the God of the flood. And there's, of course, a tremendous change theologically. The flood account of the Bible, I would say compared to the Babylonian account, but in reality contrasted, it only is a contrast with it, represents a far greater more believable theology, a far more moral theology. It's clearly a statement of a high theology that I think can be honestly looked at and say this must be a revelation because it is such a radical change from the Babylonian view. But as a historical event, the Babylonian view is actually closer because the floods there are, in the three accounts, only last for a couple of weeks, which is probably what a river flood would have done, whereas in the Bible it lasts for a year. And at 40 feet, if you give the ark, say 20 feet, sunk into the water, say 20 feet, and the riverbed is probably about 5 feet deep. Then the rest of the land, you've only got about 15 more feet of land that the water is covering. In other words, if the ark is coming down and settling as a result of this river flood, the highest hill it's going to settle on is going to be about 15 feet high. Well, it's not very hard to escape a 15 fi high foot hill in Ararat because as soon as you get to the country of Ararat, the topography begins to climb rather seriously, and the average height in the center of Ararat is about a mile high above sea level, and the mountains themselves are about 8,000 feet high on average. So there must have been a number of foothills very close by, much higher than 15 feet, and any animals or humans that were in that area could certainly have escaped the flood. So what do we do with this? Why is this account in the Bible and doesn't pan out as far as getting an ark into Ararat and wiping out mankind? And I think the answer is that the patriarchs, of course, were from Mesopotamia, and I believe they brought some of these traditions into Israel. Now, one of the traditions that was very strong in patriarchal times was that there was a worldwide flood that destroyed all mankind. So I think that tradition came into Israel through the patriarchs. And if you date Abraham, say back at 1800 or 2000 BC, and come on down, by the time you get down to Moses, you've gone through hundreds of years. Further, if the flood is really at 2900, that tradition is like at least 1500 years old before Moses even begins to write. Now, this is an aspect that hasn't very often been thought through, but the point here is the Israelites had traditions and cultural ideas that were embedded in their culture and were embedded long before Revelation came to Moses. And what happened to those traditions? Well, we learn from Jesus, for example, that there was a tradition in the culture of the Israelites that you could divorce your wife, a man could divorce his wife for any reason whatsoever. All you had to do, the additional revelation was be sure to give her a certificate of divorce. And there's a couple of little additions there. But the basic idea that you could divorce your wife for any reason whatsoever, or as the latter part of Deuteronomy 24:4 says, if you hated her, if you just hated her, was so ingrained in their culture that God doesn't try to change it. He just says, all right, look, this is ingrained in your culture that you can do this, even though later on Jesus indicates by revelation that this is not God's way, will, perfect will. But it's so ingrained in the culture that it's just left there. And with a few additions, we try to bring it up a little bit. And the same thing happens with some of the slavery laws. Slavery was embedded in the culture before Moses got there. And he just leaves it in, and even some of the laws that aren't perfectly just are left in. Or are at the same time, some of them are brought up a peg by revelation to a little higher standard. But the point is that there is a culture embedded, cultural ideas embedded in Israel and deeply embedded by the time you get to Moses. And so part of this, I think, is this flood tradition. And so when Moses sits down to write, he just has to put in this flood tradition. It's not something you could skip. It was an important, very important part of Mesopotamian thought. And I think that's why the flood tradition is in scripture. I don't know how much more we want to go into. There's more about inspiration and historicity and what have you, but
Sounds good. Thank you so much.